Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and I believe we all want to see a world where veganism is the norm. But sadly, opportunities to explore critically our different perspectives and beliefs in reaching that goal, in being an effective vegan advocate, are rare. So for today, in the name of fostering critical thinking, I decided to gather three influential vegans to debate three important questions. 1. What are the most and least effective ways to advance the vegan cause? 2. Should we advocate for veganism or reducing animal products consumption? And 3. Should vegans exclusively lead the animal rights cause? Here are the rules of the debate. I will ask the question, then each participant will have 4 minutes to answer. Then for a second round, an additional 4 minutes to respond or rebuke arguments made by other debaters. The speaking order was randomly determined. Robert Sheik, athlete, bodybuilder, vegan scent, and best-selling author, will be the first to speak. Then George Martin, animal rights activist, social media influencer, and social commentator, will then have the mic. Followed by Anne Pham. Anne Pham is this successful entrepreneur behind Body Gourmet and Boida Outwear. She's also the organizer of the Montreal and Toronto Vegan Christmas Market. The three of them have all been past guests of the show. I will leave a link in the description to the episodes we recorded together. They are all worth a listen. Okay, so my first question for you is an icebreaker question, a way to let listeners know you better and know your perspectives better. So who is your vegan hero?
Okay, well, thank you, Ryan. Thank you for having me here. And thank you to the other panelists here. Who is my vegan hero? As soon as I heard this question, the first name that comes to mind is Howard Lyman. For those that may not know, Howard Lyman is a fourth generation rancher who became an ethical vegan. He wrote the books Mad Cowboy and No More Bull and went on an animal rights speaking tour for decades. We first met about 20 years ago, and he is someone I've always looked up to, and he's the type of vegan advocate that I have aspired to be like. Like Howard, I left life on a farm to become an ethical vegan. I wrote books, and I've been on an animal rights related speaking tour for 20 years. We met many times over the years, and Howard Lyman is my vegan hero.
Thank you so much, Robert. What about you, George?
My vegan hero. Well, I have many vegan heroes that I know or see in my personal life, but I can't name them all because I'd be here all day, because I guess our true vegan heroes are the ones that we spend our days doing activism with and things like that, and who inspire us in many ways each week by spending time with them. But if I was to just say off the bat who my vegan hero is, it would be someone I've never actually met personally, and that would obviously be Gary Yourofsky, because he's the reason that I'm vegan today. It's interesting, Robert's on the panel as well, because it was through Gary that I heard of him back in like 2012, 2013. I think he was on like a list of vegan bodybuilders, maybe on the Adapt website and stuff. So I know of Robert from back in the day, from when I first went vegan. And it was Gary Yourofsky's speech that that opened my eyes to just what was happening to animals. And he's the reason that I'm vegan today. So I wouldn't be vegan without Gary Yourofsky. So it has to be Gary.
Thank you so much, George. What about you, Anne?
Who is my vegan hero? You know, in general, when I first heard that question, my reflex was to think, well, you know, in general, I don't really like the idea of idolizing or even naming one individual as a hero. Or putting one person on a pedestal. But I do have to say that I have a lot of admiration and respect for people who are involved in exposing factory farming, whether they be gathering footages inside slaughterhouses or organizing events to share that information with the public. So those will be my hero for sure. But then also heroic in my eyes are those people who run or volunteer in animal sanctuaries, because they do the tireless and thankless job every day, and that does make a difference. But if you were to ask me to name particular individuals. I would certainly want to include Dr. Melanie Joy in the group. She's a social psychologist and author who was responsible for coining the term carnism. And as you all know, carnism refers to this invisible belief system that conditions people to eat animals and to see that as normal. So she introduced that concept in her book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, for many years ago. And I think the coining of the term carnism itself significantly impacted the vegan movement and vegan advocacy in general, because it gives a name and a structure to the movement and to this unrecognized belief system that justifies eating animals. And that framework, I think, really helps people to understand the choices they make for eating animals and what justifies that reason for doing so and the arbitrary nature of doing that. So I really think if I had to name a person who's influential in the movement, I would say it's her.
Thank you, Anne. And I'm sure it resonates with George, who's also known as Carnism Debunked. So with all of those answers, I think we're ready to go in the heart of the topic of why we are here and explore with a critical eye the different ways we do activism work in the vegan community, the animal rights world. And let's start with this question. What are the most and least effective ways to advance the vegan cause? Robert, let's start with you.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. And I want to preface by saying I can be incredibly long-winded. As you know, I think our podcast was scheduled for 45 minutes and it went for an hour and 40 minutes. So what I did was I took some notes ahead of time just to help with my brevity. So indulge me for a moment as I read some of my notes regarding this topic. So to me, the most effective way to advance the vegan cause is to remove our own personal biases and to look at the data and evidence to determine what the most effective ways to advance veganism are and to incorporate those practices, whatever they turn out to be. The most effective approach to advancing the vegan cause is to provide resources and support to the organizations that do the most to help animals, which is a far greater impact than we can have on our own. That's why those organizations are in place with the talented people in the right spot, and some have been around for decades and know far more than us as individuals. The least effective ways of advancing the vegan cause are to turn people away from veganism or turn them away from compassionate behaviors, from advocacy approaches that don't resonate with them, and by not listening to the audience that we're trying to reach. We need to spend less time talking and more time listening to the objections that people have against veganism. And perhaps most of all, we need to remove our ego from the equation and look at the data and evidence and keep learning so we can be as effective for animals as possible. Ultimately, it'll be the advancements in technology and food production innovation that will reduce animal suffering more than a collective moral position to treat animals as individuals. And just to expand on that, we've had a proper animal rights movement for about 50 or 60 years now. Yet right now, 9 out of every 10 babies being born are going to grow up to be omnivores. Human population growth is vastly outpacing the rise of veganism. We're just falling behind. We're lagging behind. 99.9% of animal suffering is in the food system. We have to change the food system. And that means addressing the reasons why people eat animals. Most of us here on this screen, if you asked us, why do you eat the way you do? Or why do you live the way you do? Or your value system around food choices? We would say, oh, I'm vegan for animals, my health, and the environment. Well, guess what? Not the 99%. They don't care about those. Those don't even make their top 10. They care about taste, cost, convenience, culture, heritage, preferences, religion, societal pressures, peer pressure, social group pressure, those types of things. And so we have to understand that, because right now, as you're all probably well aware, there have been 11 peer-reviewed papers that suggest that there's going to be between 62 and 242% more animal agriculture by 2050, unless we change something in the food system. And so that comes back to basically on an individual level, how can your actions influence the behavior of those we're trying to reach to change supply and demand and also put pressure on the big corporations that are part of this industrialized factory farm food system? And so to me, the best way and most effective way to make a difference for animals is to focus our efforts in the areas where animals suffer by the greatest numbers and to the greatest degree, and that's in the food system.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, George?
Yeah, so I don't think I have an answer as elaborate and well articulated to this as Robert does, but then again, that's why he's written the book on this, and I haven't yet written a book on such a thing. The most effective way, I think, to advocate for animals, well, I would actually say in this day and age, it's through social media. We live in the digital age, and most information people consume is digital. So word of mouth and stuff, it still does exist, obviously, but obviously it's most, I think, of the information and the things we learn now is digital. And I wouldn't be vegan if it weren't for the internet, weren't for social media. So I think sharing things like slaughterhouse footage or, you know, documentaries and stuff and speeches and stuff online, I think that's proven to be just probably the main reason for the animal rights movement just snowballing within the last decade. There's just been, like Robert said, since however long it's been, there's been an animal rights movement, but still most people obviously are still oppressing animals in some way. But there hasn't been an explosion like this in vegans, in animal rights activists until maybe the last, 10, 12 or so years, something like that. And I think that is because of the digital age. They'll give you an objection like, oh, this doesn't happen in the free range egg industry. And you can just show them footage straight away of some chicks being shredded alive at hatcheries or whatever it is. And boom, like you can prove, you can validate veganism in an instant now, which is something our predecessors never had the privilege of being able to do. Donald Watson and such people weren't able to do that. The least effective way to advocate veganism, it's hard to say because I think all forms of activism are valid, but I think the least effective way is watering down our message and not conveying what's happening to animals as a moral emergency, making it just seem like a diet, making it just seem like some kind of personal choice, like, oh, you know, you do you and I, you know, and I'll do me, that kind of thing. We ultimately need to convey it in the same way that other justice movements throughout history have been conveyed, which is that this is a moral emergency. Animals are, you know, being massacred right now by the billion. Every single week this happens. And we need to make it very, very clear to the people we talk to that this is an urgent issue. It's not a diet. It's not a, you know, like a hobby or a fashion or a trend or anything like that. This is a justice movement and we need people to change immediately.
Thank you, George. Anne?
You know, I just want to echo a little bit of what Robert was saying earlier about listening to what objections people have about veganism, because I realized recently what people normally think when, or what they say when we talk about animals and how it's unethical to kill animals for food. I mean, literally I have heard people say, well, I don't really care, you know, in one way or another, they would say something like that. And it, even though it's shocking, but that is, I think, on a lot of people's mind, they just simply don't care. So keeping that in mind, I think the most effective ways to advance the vegan cause would involve like leveraging our understanding of human psychology to affect behavioral change, and applying like really marketing principles to tailor our messages to different audiences. And not just take for granted that everybody cares about animals, because that just is not the case, I think. And just as advertisements are crafted to appeal to specific demographics, I think our advocacy efforts have to adapt to to diverse motivations and barriers people face regarding veganism. I also think to achieve significant gains for the vegan movement, it's essential to engage institutions such as schools, workplaces, and promoting plant-based options, and to somehow, I'm not really sure how, but we need to really get the government support, to get government to be involved in at all levels, you know, municipal, provincial, and federal. But unfortunately, that's not what we're seeing. We're not getting that support due to the stronghold of the meat and dairy lobbies. And a powerful example of how effective government involvement can be is if we look at, let's say, the anti-smoking campaigns or the promotion of recycling or the banning of plastic bags, right? When governments actively promote a cause, the impact is massive and much more effective. And currently, we only have a small percentage of the population in Canada and globally that's vegan, despite the increasing trend over the past decade for veganism. And this, I think, is mostly because the advocacy is carried out by grassroots organizations only or through peer-to-peer efforts without top-down support. So for a person to go vegan, it requires such a shift in thinking and lifestyle, and each person reacts differently to different ways of communicating. So I really believe that we need a multifaceted approach that includes street activism, businesses promoting plant-based products, school educating students about the realities of factory farming and providing plant-based options in their cafeterias. We need the medical community to be completely behind the message promoting plant-based diets. And along with that, we also need the governments to implement programs that have policies that encourage plant-based lifestyle in public institutions and just for the general public. Because I think at the very least, we have to find ways to make it natural, normal, and necessary for the public to adopt a vegan diet. At the very least, we should start with that. And we're not having that right now. And I think that's probably the main reason why veganism hasn't grown as much despite all of the efforts in the past decade. So I really think that in achieving a transition to full veganism at a massive scale, if that's not a likely outcome for a foreseeable future, then I really think the most effective way would be to advocate both at the same time for a transition to full veganism and also to have a message in parallel of reducing meat consumption. I know that probably goes against, you know, what I truly believe we should all do, but realistically, I think we should push both messages at the same time.
Thank you, Anne. First of all, thank you so much, everyone, for respecting the time limit for this round. Now, I will avoid making commentaries and just leave you the mic in order to respond to points made by other participants. I already see commonalities in the way you talk of, you know, how to make an impact and also disparities. So I'm looking forward to listening to your commentary. So let's start with you, Robert.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Well, I took some notes there and I found some helpful pieces of insight from both George and Anne, and I appreciate that. I think one thing we need to really wrap our heads around, and I know I'm going to use this word a lot, and it's not to be offensive towards anyone, but we need to be aware of our own ego and privileges and perspectives that we have, that one of those involves the green premium. All of us on this screen very likely have no problem being inconvenienced buying an $18 vegan burger, paying double or triple the price for plant-based foods or vegan options, or for being an early adopter within veganism in whatever that is, whether that's an expensive car with non-leather seats or some other non-leather item that is first to the market, or we pay a premium price for it, or simply with our food. We are totally okay with the fact that we're going to pay double or triple the price, and it's because we have a moral perspective that encourages our behavior. But we also have to look at, and I'm probably going to say this over and over, we have to look at, as Anne pointed out, human psychology and human behavior. That's what we need to get to. At the root of all of this, we need behavior change to impact supply and demand and just simply change the way food is made. If we've all seen products come and go, that when the demand is not there, they disappear. How many of you went to work on horseback today? Perhaps none. Okay. How many people are heating your home right now with whale blubber? Okay. You all know I have this new book out, The Impactful Vegan. It's the number one best-selling animal rights book in the world as we speak. Does anybody have a duck or goose feather I can use to sign books? I can go on and on. And this is not because we collectively, as a nation, as a society, as a people, decided that horses are being exploited and we have to stop it. It's because we invented the bicycle and the automobile, and horses were no longer needed for mainstream society to be used in that form for transportation and hauling supplies. We got kerosene and other ways to heat our homes and use that as power. We didn't have to continue to hunt whales, these majestic individuals. And we change in all kinds of other areas. We have regular pens I can sign as many books as possible with. And I know we've got a couple Canadians on the call today. Are you tuning in today via your BlackBerry? Probably not. Right. So society changes. Society tells us what is acceptable or what we're going to use and what we're going to exploit and what we're going to see as commodities. And I really have to believe that this green premium is a barrier. And I know I've lived a vegan lifestyle for almost 30 years, since the late 1900s. I've seen so many friends, family, colleagues, associates say, you know what? It's a barrier for me. The price is a barrier. The convenience is a barrier. And you know what? The taste is also a barrier. But we have over 1,300 companies globally. It's probably more than that right now. That's an old stat from my book. It's probably 1,400 or more companies globally working on alternative protein solutions, precision fermentation, making meat from cultivated cells, from fermented vegetables, from plants, from all sorts of things that require far less cruelty than our current food system. And as a society, we have proven. I don't know about where you live, in the UK and Canada, but I suspect it's very similar. 80% of Americans eat fast food once per week. 37% of Americans eat fast food every day. 20% of Americans eat one meal a day in their car. We have proven we don't care where our food comes from. So that's what we've got to change the food system to be more compassionate.
Amazing. Thank you, Robert. By the way, I love Blackberries. I am so sad that they have been discontinued. It's such a great cell phone. Okay, George, what about you?
Yeah, so I do agree with Robert that we obviously an innovation does help a lot for moving past ways in which we do things, but we still have to topple the mentality, right? Obviously, yeah, we're no longer taking a horse and carriage to work like we would have done back in the day, but yet horses are still being exploited and murdered. Robert mentioned the ducks as well. Obviously, we don't have a quill pen, but yet people are still eating ducks. So this is still happening to animals. So we need to still eradicate the mentality. The green premium thing, I don't really agree with that thing so much as a concept because non-vegans still pay more ultimately than vegans do for their weekly shopping budget because they're buying steaks and all the most expensive things in the supermarket. They're using cost as an excuse. Like no, obviously the cheapest foods all in the supermarkets are all vegan products. There are certain trendy plants based products like Robert mentioned, like certain plant-based burgers and stuff, which might be double the price of a dead cow burger. But on the whole, like we all know that we can get a much cheaper shop by being a vegan and not buying all those most expensive products in the shops. So I think when it comes to that, if someone is being the thing is with the thing about the cost. Most people who use that argument, I think, are being disingenuous. But the ones who are being genuine about it, and they genuinely do actually believe that it's more expensive being vegan, and I would be vegan, but I just can't afford it. Well, it's just easy to point them to how to live very easily and cheaply as a vegan. You can point them to the fact that the most impoverished societies worldwide subsist on rice, beans, lentils, potatoes, noodles, all those sorts of things. Yeah.
Thank you, George. Anne, your turn.
I'm not really sure how to address the green premium because I think some people, you're right, George, do use that as an excuse, just to not try the vegan option, just to say that it's too expensive. But in some cases, I think it is true. There is a markup for buying things that are vegan or that are organic, that are, whatever, gluten-free, whatever you name it, and it is part of the pricing structure in a lot of grocery stores to charge that premium because it's vegan. So I wouldn't like disregard that objection completely. I think we need to address it maybe differently. I'm not exactly sure how it will be effective because it really depends on who's objecting. I feel like some people are really being genuine about that criticism and some people are just using it as an excuse. But I would say that we really have to focus on how do we get people to change their behavior, something that has been that is so ingrained in our psychology, in our culture, to eat meat and to see that as completely normal. And that's, I think, is a hurdle to get over, to get somebody to change, because it's to most people, it's so normal that it's tough to even consider giving that up. And the idea of having to change a habit that's a lifelong habit, I mean, just imagine any habit that you have right now that you want to get rid of, you know, whether it's scrolling too much on the phone or I don't know, not exercising enough, whatever it is, if we set ourselves a goal to change that habit, imagine how hard it is to just maintain that for a week or two, right? So imagine you have to now, let's say, completely change your whole diet for forever. Like that's a really big obstacle for someone to get over and to make that mental shift. So I'm not sure, but I think we really need to look into the science of behavioral change and, you know, whatever that's out there to really craft our message to make it more effective, I find. I find right now it's kind of all over the place. You know, we just, as Robert mentioned, we use a lot of our ego. We react very strongly to certain things that we're angry with. So we react very emotionally sometimes, and that may not be the most effective in advocating for the cause. And on social media, I find a lot of times it feels a bit toxic. There's a lot of, you know, snarky comments. So yeah, I just feel like we're not coordinated in our efforts enough in pushing out that message to the public.
Thank you, Anne. By the way, I want to spare 5 minutes at the end of this recording for parting words. So if you have a point, an additional point to address, please save it for those last 5 minutes. Okay, so I think we're ready for the second question, which is, and you touched on that, and should we advocate for veganism or reducing animal products consumption in our approach? Robert, I give you the floor.
Okay, thank you so much. And thanks for allowing 5 minutes at the end, because I think I do have some insights and solutions to some of those issues regarding changing behavior within the food system. But now we're going to go on an adventure together. Okay, because I prepared some notes this morning for this topic. Should we advocate for veganism or reducing animal product consumption? My response might surprise some of you. I've always been an ethical vegan for the animals since day one. But as I spent 2.5 years writing a book on how to most effectively reduce animal suffering, I came to this idea that I wrote down today. To me, it's similar to the idea of advancing an organized religion or advancing some of the key components of a particular religion. What's better, to promote Christianity as a dogmatic worldview and lifestyle, or to promote the golden rule? Will it be easier to get everyone to become a Christian, or to get as many people as possible to incorporate compassion into their lives, embracing the golden rule as just part of their lifestyle behavior, and assuming the result is a net positive based on the goals of those pursuing particular results, which outcome is more likely to be most effective or impactful? I am not a Christian, but I have more Christ-like tendencies and behaviors than most Christians because of my actual habits, value systems, and actions that are largely in line with the golden rule, which is partly, you know, associated with Christianity, of treating others the way I, or more importantly, they would like to be treated. Am I therefore effective in spreading compassion, or ineffective because I do not embrace all the tenets of Christianity? And to what degree does that matter regarding an end goal? I would leave this cautionary note to everyone listening. Here I go again. Sometimes your own bias towards veganism gets in the way of doing the most good for animals. You want everyone to become vegan for the same reasons you became vegan, or because of the reasons that matter most to you. You have ego wrapped up in the label of veganism, and that can oftentimes blind you from embracing some of the most efficacious approaches to reducing animal suffering. If just becoming vegan is the goal, that is a battle we will never win. Just like we will never live in a world where everyone believes in the same God, or shares the same ethical value system. That just won't happen. We can't even agree on important topics as citizens of a single country. It's audacious to believe that someday everyone will care about animals the way you care about them. If we can't even argue on the same, if we can't even agree on the same God, or how to treat women or minorities or the poor or the mentally ill or other groups, how can we realistically expect a society of any significant size to agree on how to treat animals? Therefore, what I focus on, of course, I have a moral, ethical imperative toward veganism. I have a kind of personal abolitionist approach. But when I look at efficacy, what does the most good? I address this in many chapters of my new book, and I don't have time for it today, but we have to look, as Anne pointed out, we have to look at particular demographics who are most likely to adopt compassionate behavior. We have to look at who's making food purchases. 80% of all food purchases are made by women. 70 to 80% of all meals for an entire family are prepared by women. We have to look at, within the United States, the Black community, the African-American community is the fastest growing demographic within veganism. We have to acknowledge why that is happening and how that's growing, and representation is part of it. Doing a plant-based by default approach is part of it. What I call the forks over knives effect is part of it. Taking small incremental steps toward forward progress, which is the Kaizen system, is part of it. My guess is that everybody on the screen would love to have people go vegan overnight. I mean, I did on December 8th, 1995. Why can't the rest of you? But that's not the way the 99% operates. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robert. George?
Yeah, so I do see the animal rights movement as an inherently abolitionist movement. Now, obviously, I'd rather people reduced than didn't reduce, if that's all we're going to get from them, if they were never going to go vegan. But I don't think we should promote reducitarianism. We should promote abolitionism, because when we do so, people will naturally reduce anyway. If people reject that and say, I'm never going to go vegan, but to be fair, the guy has got a point, maybe I'll buy some oat milk instead of dairy or something like that. I mean, this is something I've seen in my own personal life. I've never, ever promoted reducitarianism in any form. In fact, I specifically tell people, you know, no, don't just cut that out. Why not just go vegan? But nonetheless, people around me, you know, friends, family and stuff who are still non-vegan and non-vegan friends and family in my life, they will naturally just become reducitarians, flexitarians and stuff anyway, as a result of me promoting abolitionism. So that's the problem. If we promote reducitarianism, a reducitarian world is the most we will get. If we promote veganism, yeah, I know, I agree with what Robert said. It is, it seems at the moment, an extremely unrealistic goal for a vegan world. But ultimately, I think there's a big cultural aspect in that. I do think every secular country in the world at least one day will be vegan for the right reasons, and we'll look back on animal slavery in the same way that we look back on human slavery, which is why I guess we should, like, I wouldn't agree with Robert's analogy of the religion thing, because I think we should compare it not to a religion but a moral obligation. Robert mentioned that you know, we shouldn't want people to just go vegan for the reasons that you are vegan. We should just want them to be vegan for whatever the reason it is. But I would say that the reason to be vegan, the only reason to be vegans, is the reason that I'm vegan, for the animal rights reasons. If someone is just plant-based, they're plant-based. They're still going to be enslaving animal elephants at the circus. They're still going to be riding horses. They're still going to be going fishing for sport. But, you know, don't worry, I won't kill the fish. I'll just catch and release them, throw them back, kind of thing. So those people aren't vegan just because they eat a plant-based diet. Put it this way, I would rather live in a world where the reason that we didn't sexually assault people was because we take the consent of the victim into account. Not a world where, well, most of us, the reason we don't do it is because we take the consent of the victim into the account. But then a good majority of people, well, the reason we don't do it is because you might get an STI if you do this. So there are absolutely wrong, selfish reasons to do something. And I don't think we should do that at all. So, yeah, I would just say abolitionist message. And at the same time, we should also just promote veganism for being about animal rights. And we shouldn't accept it if someone says, Oh, I'm vegan, but for my health, we should correct them. We say, well, that's not veganism. Veganism is about the animals. If you're vegan for your health, you're still unfortunately enslaving and abusing animals in other way. And long does animal oppression continue if we live in a world like that?
Thank you, George. Anne?
I would say that at my core and right off the bat, I would think that the ab abolitionist message would be the one that's most consistent and the most logical one, because it wouldn't make sense to say, let's say we're talking about racism, we wouldn't tell people, let's just be a little less racist instead of just saying, let's not be racist at all, right? So if we draw a parallel between that and advocating for veganism, it would only make sense to say, let's not abuse animal, exploit them at all, as opposed to let's abuse them less or fewer of them. But that being said, though, I do want to think about, in terms of numbers, I think the question requires a bit of a nuanced approach. I mean, because despite the growing trend over the past several years, it's still incredibly difficult to increase the percentage of the world population of vegans, right? We're still currently what, roughly about 3% of the population worldwide that's vegan, and it's been hovering there for a while now. So it's really difficult to make any significant headway, I find. And there are a lot of reasons why the progress is so slow. It's because the obstacle is that eating meat is part of practically every culture. Unlike racism, we can always say, okay, well, we're all human, so let's all, be more equal and treat each other more fairly. Like, we all recognize that, we all agree with that. But eating meat, though, we're not talking about another species. So there's like speciesism mixed in there, and it's hard to get over that, I find. So we can't really compare that with the other causes completely because it's not totally the same, I find. And another thing I find is that we have to find like a place somewhere between being idealistic and pragmatic. So I find that advocating for complete veganism, it sets a clear and uncompromising goal, which is important for maintaining the integrity of the animal rights message. But given the challenges, it's worth considering the impact of advocating for reducing animal product consumption at the same time, even if that seems contradictory, because I think it's possible to hold both ideas at once and roll out both strategies, and they need not cancel each other out. I think different strategies will simply resonate better with different people. Like, 'cause I actually run some numbers, just hypothetical calculations. So let's say every year a person eats, let's say on average 100 animals, including land animals, fish, and all of the wild and farm fish. So, and we're about what, 7.9 billion people worldwide on our planet. So that's 790 billion animals that's killed every year for food. So scenario A, let's say we somehow magically achieved 15% of the worldwide population that becomes vegan. Let's just say a generous number, even though we're only at 3% now, but let's say we've achieved 15% of the worldwide population that's gone vegan completely. So that would mean that we would save 118 billion animals each year. Now, if you compare that to the second scenario, where let's say only 60% of the world population that reduces their consumption of meat by 30%, not 50 or 60, let's just by 30. If you make that calculation, you'll see that we would be saving 142 billion animals per year. So the number there's a discrepancy, there's a difference between the numbers already. And if veganism is about reducing or eliminating suffering of animals, we really have to think of the end results, the numbers, and numbers, I think, do matter. So to me, we should really push out both strategy of both reducing animal consumption as well as the abolition of animal exploitation altogether.
Thank you, Anne. So now time to respond to the points made. Let's start with you, Robert.
Yeah, thank you. So it appears that George and I disagree on a number of things. So I'll address that. I mean, it sounds poetic. Let's all promote veganism and let's have this animal rights message and all that. Well, how's it working? And I think your numbers are wrong. We're less than 1% globally vegan. You have to factor in total world population. We have 8 billion people and about 80 million vegans. We're less than 1%. We've been doing this for 60 years. How's it working? It's not. I also have or take issue, and I mean that, gently. I take issue with the idea that vegan is the end goal. I don't think so. I think reducing animal suffering. is the end goal. For example, and there's no ego attached to this, I have all the data in my book, Ryan has read it. The average vegan spares 174 to 365 animal lives per year, almost one per day. I spare over 100,000 animal lives per year with my approach, with the Vegan Strong method, with what I call the Strong V approach, with my mega best-selling books, with my tour that I'm on every single weekend for months on end right now, with all that stuff, influence on influential people who, again, promote sometimes a reducitarian type approach. And by the way, I used to scoff at that. In fact, I reluctantly went to the reducitarian summit to end factory farming. I didn't even want to go. I had no interest in it. But I looked at the numbers. Just like Ann pointed out, the numbers don't lie. There's data there that we can evaluate it. We can look at it and we can see what works. And we need to focus on reducing animal suffering, not just trying to get everyone to become vegan. This is a note I wrote down. We're asking people to make an entire lifestyle overhaul. Change your worldview completely. Change everything you know about what you eat, what you believe, how you think about animals, how you think about the world around you. That's hard to do. But to get someone to reduce their level of exploitation towards animals is so much easier to do using, again, what I call our Strong V or Vegan Strong method, to lead by positive example and get people to replace their, on average, 3,540 calories consumed per day with as many calories from plants instead of animals as possible. And that adds up to numbers that we can measure, evaluate, and look at as far as the efficacy of reducing suffering globally. And again, I share all of those numbers in the writing that I've done recently.
Thank you, Robert. George?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree with Robert that it's not working great, but it's working better than it ever was, as in the promoting the abolitionist vegan message. I know that obviously most people in the world just aren't vegan, and it seems just like the easy thing to do, you know, to get people to reduce. But ultimately, the reason we're all vegan to begin with is because someone promoted the idea that actually reducitarianism is not enough. If we all had the idea that reducitarianism was good, was okay, simply put, none of us here would be vegan. Why would we? If we're not hooked on the message that reducitarianism is bad, that vegetarianism is bad, that flexitarianism is bad, that pescatarianism is bad, well, I would be eating a cheese pizza right now. You know, I might not have some pepperoni on it, but I wouldn't be here talking to you guys about this. I wouldn't be a vegan, right? Why would I be? Because it hasn't been put straightforward enough to me that all these things are immoral to fund. I completely agree that unfortunately it's not working great overall when we look at the numbers worldwide of how many people are vegan. But it's still working hundreds of times better than it ever was in history, because recently we have promoted abolitionist animal rights and we've proliferated that message through social media, through documentaries like Earthlings, Dominion, all that kind of stuff. And yes, reducitarianism will ultimately spare a lot of animals, but it plateaus once you just have, you know, if you, as I say again, if you have just reducitarianism. And maybe, you know, I don't want to mischaracterize anyone's argument here. I'm sure Robert isn't saying just to promote reducitarianism because he's a vegan after all. But what I am saying is reducitarianism does plateau, whereas the end goal of veganism is absolutely, well, it is the abolition of animal suffering as well. So with that comes the abolition of animal, is ending all animal suffering. Is that if everyone in the world is vegan, there's no animal oppression anymore. And I just wanted to pick up on maybe one of Anne's points as well that she mentioned. It is comparable to all the other injustices because those injustices are deep-rooted and normalized in other societies. They may not be in the West anymore, but they were throughout history. So we do still have to look at speciesism in the same way that we do look at human slavery, at the Holocaust, at women being stoned to death in Islamic countries because, you know, they foregone their arranged marriage, at people, you know, having their tongues cut out because they blasphemed, whatever it is. We have to look at all these are normal in certain countries, and these were normal things to do throughout history. This was the norm. This is where you can't have a society where we don't do this, the blasphemers. What are you talking about? This is crazy and all this. And again, even certain mentalities that we've had throughout history, these seemed like big lifestyle changes. It seemed might have seemed like a lifestyle change for people not to have owned slaves, for example. It was completely changing the way that society functioned and worked. But nonetheless, we have to aim for that because we shouldn't stand for anything less than total liberation.
Thank you, George. And finally, Anne.
Just to clarify what I meant when I was saying that, veganism isn't the same as the other social causes. I think what I meant was because the other social causes, we all start from the common ground, being that we're all humans, right? So if we're advocating for equal rights between men and women, we can always go back to the very idea that, hey, men. A man and a woman are they're both humans, but we can't say the same with animals and humans. They'll always be a part of our human consciousness, and we'll always think we're another species from the animals. That's I think that's the hurdle where it's really difficult to convince everyone that we're all the same, that we all deserve the same rights, that we all deserve to not be exploited. I think that's a lot of the hurdle we have to overcome. So that's what I was saying when I said that the veganism is not the same as the other social causes. Now you were saying about reducing. I get what you're saying, that reducing is not consistent with the message that we should abolish, exploitation of animals altogether. But it's just I just find it's not realistic. And even though we feel like if 15% is hard, I mean, how would we ever reach 100%? So I feel like it's just not a realistic goal. So it's just a matter of practicality for me. So that's where I stand, even though at the very core, I feel like the abolition is the way to go, but the numbers just don't reflect that, I feel. So to me, it just makes more sense to use both the abolitionist message as well as the reductionist one.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you, everyone, for all of those excellent answers and points and arguments. I think we're ready now for the last question of this episode. And the question is, should vegans exclusively lead the animal rights cause? Or put in another way, can non-vegans, is there a place for non-vegans to lead animal rights fights? Robert?
Yeah, thank you, Ryan, and thanks, George and Anne. This has been fun. I only have a few notes written for this one, so I want to just take a quick moment to just add that this idea that if we should be vegan, and that's the message we should be promoting, why is vegan recidivism so high? It's incredibly high. People just don't stick with it. I have for 30 years. You've stuck with it for a while, but most don't. And I also call for a moral emergency. Those are the exact words that I used in my book. In fact, I quote a now former non-vegan, Alex O'Connor, in my book about his moral emergency speech. So I just want to clarify, I'm not the guy advocating for reducitarianism. In fact, like I told you, I scoffed at that idea. And I do call for a moral emergency, but I also look at the data, the data, the data, the data, and the data. And it shows that those who follow a plant-based diet, even for their health and their wellness and the forks over knives effect, and they stick with it for decades, it has a dramatic impact on reducing animal suffering and normalizing a plant-based diet and making it accessible and palatable for anyone. Now, onto the topic at hand. I literally only have a few notes here. So, should vegans exclusively lead the animal rights cause? Using the word lead sounds dogmatic and almost cult-like in a way, but I understand the use of the word here. I would not want to be considered as a leader in the vegan movement, but I think that to maintain the integrity of the vegan moral value system and that ethical vegans should actively be involved in the advancement of the vegan movement. But we also need strong allies from outside the vegan movement, including those in positions of influence, power, wealth, and those with connections to other potential allies if we're going to grow as a movement. And I've been around for a long time. Again, a lot of people have been vegan longer than me, but I've just been around since the late 1900s watching a lot of this stuff. And so many things that we all enjoy, these vegan burgers and all that, many of those were not made possible whatsoever without the investments from non-vegan celebrities, musicians, athletes, actors, wealthy individuals. I know many of these companies. I work with over 125 plant-based companies. I know who invests in them. I worked for the plant-based nutrition company that revolutionized plant-based sports nutrition forever. I wrote about it in my book. It was led by a totally non-vegan who ended up selling the company for over $500 million, but opened up the doors to replace millions and millions of animal-based protein drinks with plant-based ones. And it normalized it. And those products became the best-selling in America alongside animal-based protein powders and such. So we have to realize that we celebrate these wins, right? We celebrate these wins with vegan food or with policy or political action or whatever, forgetting oftentimes that it was our allies and wealthy donors who helped make that possible. That's even true for my own book tours. I get supported by non-vegan people who fund my vegan outreach. This would not be possible. I wouldn't have a New York Times best-selling book, you know, translated 9 languages that really has changed people's lives. I hear about it in feedback all the time. That came from non-vegans investing into my work because they believed in me and the core principles and messages that I promote, even if they themselves are not vegan. We have to recognize that. Also, my last comment here, what's working, what's not working. Animal consumption, meat consumption, if you will, but animal consumption is at an all-time low in the UK and Germany right now. And that's because of all kinds of things, not just an abolition approach, but because plant-based options are plentiful. They're available. They're everywhere. They're normalized. They're popularized. They're supported. Supply and demand kicked in. And now we see reduction of animal suffering as an all-time high in some of those countries. And we can do the same in the US and Canada and elsewhere if we adopt those principles, which is at the heart of what I'm trying to get at. If 99.9% of animal suffering is in the food system, that's what we need to tackle. That's what we need to change. And we have to look at the data and evidence to determine how to most effectively do that.
Thank you, Robert. Anne, your answer?
Well, I think vegans are naturally positioned to lead the animal rights cause due to their personal commitment and the understanding of the issues. But it's crucial to build an inclusive coalitions that involve non-vegans as well, just because we're still a marginal group. And I think we could benefit from having collaborations with, you know, other people and just being inclusive, basically. To me, it makes sense to evaluate our action based on the outcome rather than ideology. Again, that comes back to the question of ego, right? I mean, it's not so much about falling under a certain label. It's just we want to look at the results and what works the best. And I just think that collaborating with allies who may not be fully vegan, but who are supportive of reducing animal suffering, then we can really leverage on a broader range of resources and influence.
Thank you, Anne. Sorry, George, misstep here. I know it was your turn. So George, what's your answer?
Yeah, thanks. So with regards to this question, I think it depends on the type of action that we're talking about. If we're talking about things like outreach advocacy, it only makes sense to have vegans at those events. I don't want non-vegans at, I don't know, a Cube of Truth or whatever it is, talking to other non-vegans on the street. And well, number one, what are they going to be saying to these people? And number two, why are they going to take the message seriously if it's some guy standing there wearing cow flesh on their shoes and maybe with a Big Mac in one hand saying, hey, you should be vegan or something like that? That's just going to be silly, right? But when it comes to things like direct actions or something like that, yeah, I mean, if I have a non-vegan friend who says, I'm going to go and break into a gas chamber tonight and stop a pig from being gassed to death, I'm not going to go, you can't because you're not vegan. I might pick him up on it. I might say, well, hang on, like, what? That's great that you're doing this, but what is the reason that you're doing this kind of thing, and go from there. So it depends on the type of action, I guess. And when it comes to actually promoting certain people at the forefront of our movement, Yeah, once again, they should be animal rights activists and vegans, so that we should be consistent in that regard. But we shouldn't turn away help where we can get it. If Donald Trump says he's going to donate $1 billion to PETA, don't turn down the $1 billion just because Donald Trump isn't vegan. Take that money and thank Donald Trump for the $1 billion injection, I would say in that case. Yeah, I guess overall there my answer is kind of nuanced. It all kind of depends on what it is.
Thank you, George. I see a kind of overall agreement on this question. Robert?
Yeah, well, obviously it's good to find some common ground. And to be honest, and I told Ryan this is the first debate style conversation I have had in 28 and a half years of being a vegan, because I look at I mentioned Strong V earlier. I might as well say what it is. It's using our skills, talents, resources, other strengths, network, generosity, and volunteering to most effectively reduce animal suffering. And debating is not one of my strengths or skills or talents. And so I'm just sharing ideas based on years and years and years of writing books on the subject of veganism. So I am glad that we agreed. Of course, if we're going to maintain the integrity, and we Anne made this point almost exactly what I had in my notes, the exact word, maintain the integrity of the vegan, moral value system, we do need vegans at the forefront. But as George said, we got to take support where we can get it. I'm just using my own anecdotal experience here, just on this particular topic, which I alluded to earlier. I would not be where I am as far as an influential vegan speaker and author touring like literally all over the world, five continents. I'm pretty good at what I do without the funding of non-vegans. I mean, I even had a fully funded tour for half a decade by a non-vegan company that sent me out on the road to talk about building your body on a plant-based diet. That was literally the topic of conversation. Why? Because their plant-based products were associated with it and all that. But that gave me a platform to use my championship vegan bodybuilding physique and background and my, if you want to call it charisma, whatever you want to say, my ability to connect with audiences. That was monumental. And that led to all the things that I do now, the best-selling books and everything. And that wouldn't have happened if I didn't accept the support from non-vegans. And that's why I said even the biggest companies you can imagine, the Beyond Meats of the world and all of that, they have all kinds of non-vegans, investing into their company, helping them grow, and all of that. So really, in summary, and Anna, I appreciate what you said about an hour ago. You mentioned grassroots movement. I talk about that. I've always been a fan of community organizers and grassroots movement. Folks are always going to be at the foundation of any movement. But we also, in order to get to a tipping point, to that 10% or 15%, as you optimistically said, we are going to need celebrities and influencers and allies. And look at all these people. I mean, how long have each of you been vegan? There's a time you weren't, right? Look at these the people right now that we're getting money or support from, who could very easily be the next major vegan advocate or vegan ally. And I mean, Earthling Ed wasn't vegan all that long ago. I told his story in the book of how that happened. It happened from a news story, when the truck of chickens tipped over and he had dead chickens in his refrigerator and thought of that juxtaposition right there and questioned his own moral value system. You never know. You never know. There are plenty of non-vegans who are tremendous allies, and our movement would not be where it is without them. I think we just have to acknowledge the facts. That's 100% factual. And also respect it a little bit, besides saying we just need vegans and vegans only. It's like having a vegan run a business if they have no idea how to run a business. You can't just put a vegan in as a CEO just because they're vegan. They have no idea what they're doing. Same with maybe they have no idea how to be a grassroots organizer, community organizer, or to get a movement going. They just happen to not eat animals and care about animals. So we need people using the right skill sets. That's why I created the Strong V. You got to do what you're great at. And when you can apply what you're great at and allow other people to inject what they're great at, then we can move a movement forward at a rapid pace. And that's how we create real change.
Thank you, Robert. I will respect George's turn now. So, George, the mic is yours.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add really to anything that Robert said. I mean, I would just maybe reiterate all that it was that I would said I had said before, we should absolutely take help where we can get it, just while still advocating a strong vegan message. And also at the same time, not being scared to point out inconsistencies, that positive reinforcement that we have with families and friends. If someone is, you know, what Melanie Joy, for example, would call a vegan ally, it's good that we do accept their support and that we're grateful for what they're doing to advance animal rights in that sense. But we should also, you know, say, you know, do you think that it, you know, given that you do support what it is that we do and all that kind of stuff, you know, do you have you thought about being vegan yourself? So that's all I guess I would add to that. I don't really have anything to add.
Thank you, George. And final response.
I guess I don't have much to add either, but it is a backdoor way of getting more non-vegans to come on board by accepting their help by whichever way we can at first, and later on to say, well, you know, since you're already helping, this is, you know, the motivation behind it is really to reduce animal suffering and to stop it, and also in, I think by letting them on board, we have more chances of convincing them than just, you know, having these two camps that are very opposing each other from the get-go. And I also like this idea of like effective altruism, when you have like, you accept money, you put your money where it helps the most, whether it's to an organization that does a lot of help. So if we were to think of veganism and we have non-vegans investing in vegan businesses, how that is more helpful than rejecting their help altogether. We have to see it that way, you know. So like if it's something is helpful, even though they're not vegans, it may actually advance more the cause than we think. So it's so yeah, I agree with everyone that we definitely should get the help where we get it.
Amazing. What a wonderful way to end this this exercise. As promised, I want to give you each 5 more minutes to make a last comments, maybe about the questions that were asked or to respond to a point someone made. So please go ahead, starting with Robert.
Okay, and thank you once again. This has been really fun. My first time doing a debate style conversation. It's been a joy. Honored to be with all of you. George, let's go back to the food for a moment. You talked about well, the cheapest foods in the world are plants. People should just eat that, you know. You know, and maybe they're paying more. You didn't buy the green premium argument. And that's okay, because again, I'm most interested in listening to people's objections, not our objections as vegans, but the 99%. Why do they not care about animals? And to your point, Anne, and I wrote this down many times, the I don't care response is the number one. There's obstacles and objections about protein intake and worry about health and wellness and all that, but I don't care is absolutely number one. And to your point, or someone's point, many people are aware of how animals go from turning into animals to turn into food, and they still don't care. And we've seen that over and over and over. So, George, why is it that that people are unwilling to change their nutritional behavior? I wrote some notes down here. Part of it is people do not want to give up their power and privilege. People talk about, I didn't climb to the top of the food chain just to eat rice and beans. Well, first of all, you didn't climb anywhere. You inherited an incredible privilege to be able to eat animals, and that's, you know, something you're choosing to do for you know, your own reasons. But part of it is people are more afraid of letting go of something than acquiring something. People are scared to let go of power, of influence, of dominion, of choice, of preference, of privilege, if I didn't say that already. And so yeah, we have a food system where people maybe eat plants, but still exploit animals in other ways. They buy a leather wallet, leather belt, but I can promise you, nobody, I don't care who you are, Kim Kardashian, nobody's buying six wallets every single day, or six pairs of shoes, or six hats or purses every single day. But everybody sits down to eat six times a day. Everyone in the Western world that has adequate access to calories, I should say. 1 billion people go to bed hungry every night, which is unfortunate. So people don't want to give that up. And also, what I think is rather obvious, why do people eat the way they eat? Sugar, oil, and salt. It's cheap fried food. They cannot stop. They cannot get enough of it. They love pizza, fries, burgers, soda, ice cream. That's just the way it is. So we have to understand human nature, and we have to make those products that are as cruelty-free as possible. And there are many organizations like the Good Food Institute who are working with foreign governments around the world. They have a $50 million annual budget, and they're working with 1,400 companies that are doing just that. And also, just as a fun little note here at the end, I actually wrote a 35-page paper on the most affordable food in the world. And drum roll, please. This is the most nutrition percent that you can possibly get. It's the mighty lentil. The lentil provide dried lentils provide the most nutrition per penny spent, followed by beans, oats, and rice. No surprise, but guess what? Nobody wants to eat it. They don't want to give up the privilege. They want sugar, oil, salt, taste, cost, convenience. Give it to me. That's what they want. That's what we have to give them in as cruelty-free form as possible.
Thank you, Robert. I absolutely love lentils. Hooray for the lentils. George, your turn.
Yeah, I don't have a huge amount to add, really. I agree that we do need to provide, unfortunately, it's the way it is, we do need to provide people with these foods. I'm by no means a health food vegan myself. I would still be vegan regardless of whether there was all this amazing junk load that we can eat. But I do accept that unfortunately there are a lot of people who are simply too selfish to change for unless they have like products that replicate perfectly all these things. So I do think we should help drive innovation and support these companies in creating these amazing plant-based alternatives that are hitting the supermarket shelves right now. So for me, it's about ultimately we have to take a two-pronged attack here. We have to drive the innovation that do appeal to people's selfishness, but we also need to advance animal rights via a very strong moral message. We need to make it very clear that animal oppression is wrong in all forms. And even though it seems like a long and arduous uphill battle now to undertake that, I do think that one day, ultimately, we will look back on the way now that we treat animals in the same way that we look back on all the other historical oppressions. Was it Leonardo da Vinci who said there will come a time now when men such as I will look back now on the murder of animals as we look upon now the murder of men. So yeah, for me, it's about advancing both of those things.
Thank you, George. Final words, Anne.
Yeah, well, I would definitely agree with that strategy of advancing both messages. I think it's hard because, as a vegan at the core, it's always hard to think that we cannot just promote only the ethical aspect of veganism because it doesn't feel intuitive to just tell people to just reduce their consumption, but not to try to push too much of the ethical aspect of it. But yeah, I mean, we just have to be practical about this, and I think that the best way really is to promote both messages. Just because that's we have to consider not everyone is starting from the same standpoint as we are. Because I went vegan for purely ethical reasons, but that's not where everybody starts from. So we just have to, take cognizance of that starting point for other people as well, I think.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you everyone for having participated, for having accepted my invitation. I'm not sure, tell me, but I don't think there is such an initiative out there. I don't know if there are many debates that have been done on different ways of doing activism or, debates that are not targeted to non-vegans, debates between vegans. I hope this helped, foster critical thinking and cl clarify points for listeners or start a reflection somewhere on what's the best way to make progress, because we need to make progress. Like you all stated before, we're not making, we want to do more and we want the progress to go faster. And this is a moral emergency. So thank you again, everyone. Thank you for your time. And yeah. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.
Thanks for putting this together. This was great. This was fun. Maybe I should do more of these. This is you take taking it easy on me. I was actually nervous for like weeks about this. Like, tell my wife, oh no, my first debate. I got my collared shirt on. I had my bottle of water, my notes. I typed things up. I rehearsed and timed it. Oh, but it was much easier than I expected. I thought it would be much more stressful. So this was very pleasant. So thank you.